Welcome to the Marlborough Book Festival podcast. Get ready for an inspiring weekend from the evening of July 25 through to Sunday, July 28. Visit marlboroughbookfest.co.nz to learn more about this wonderful weekend for book lovers. For now, please enjoy this session from the 2023 Marlborough Book Festival.
Good morning. My name is Brock Campbell. I'm here today representing Cloudy Bay. It's our great privilege, and we're grateful to be able to help with the Marlborough Book Festival again this year. Whether you're just here for today's session or part of the larger festival, I've been struck by the level of diversity of the speakers and the program itself. Let's kick in. It's my great pleasure to again to introduce Nikki McDonald and Catherine Kidgey as part of our The Axemen Carnival program. Thank you and enjoy.
Thanks very much for that, Brock, and thanks again to Cloudy Bay, who are the sponsors of this session. Well, welcome everybody. It's fantastic to see a full house here. You're going to be in for a treat, I'm sure. Just a little bit of housekeeping to start with. Presumably you know where the exits are because you came in them. If there is an earthquake, please drop cover and hold. There will be time for questions at the end of the session. And there will also be time after the session to go and buy books and get them signed by Catherine and actually by Tama. So that's a privilege. Now, look, obviously to most of you, Catherine is going to require no introduction. She's somewhat greedily at the moment currently occupying two of the top 10 slots on New Zealand's fiction bestseller list. And she really is a superstar of New Zealand writing. With, I think, 10 books to your name.
If we count the children's books.
Yes, yeah. We do count the children's books. She is incredibly prolific, despite also having a full-time teaching job at teaching creative writing at Waikato University. Her novel, The Axemen's Carnival, which is what we're going to be talking about today, this year won the Jan Medlicott Acorn Prize for Fiction, which makes Catherine the only writer to have won this premier award twice. The novel is set on a central Otago high country sheep station where second-generation farmer Rob is falling deeper and deeper into the red amid drought and falling wool prices. Wife Marnie is grieving the loss of a baby and adopts a tiny magpie, which fell from its nest. The cheeky mimic becomes our narrator, witness, and internet superstar. It's funny, moving, and disturbing, and if you haven't read it already, go out and buy it because it will almost certainly be the best thing that you'll read all year. So please join me in welcoming Catherine Kidgey. So Catherine, your last two novels, The Wish Child and Remote Sympathy, were about Nazi Germany. Where in earth did the idea come from to write a tragicomedy with a magpie as narrator?
Thanks, Nikki. Good morning, everyone. So I am really sorry that I have to start things off on a negative note. I have to make apologies for Tama Magpie. He is unable to be here this morning. Last night he got stuck into the Cloudy Bay Pinot and the Dog Point Chardonnay. Continued drinking this morning. I left him in the ensuite singing sea shanties. He's in no shape to appear. I can only apologise. Yes, I know. It does seem like a real change of direction.
It does.
I had got the, you know, World War II Germany out of my system with those two books. I thought I had with The Wish Child, and then I realised that, no, actually, I'm not quite finished with that. I want to go back and, you know, The Wish Child is very much a domestic story. I want to take a kind of step further into that darkness and talk about a story inside a concentration camp. And I wrote my two children's books during the writing of those two quite heavy novels, I think, because I felt like I needed a change of pace and kind of a palate cleanser. And then with my next novel, I just wanted to do something completely different again. I'd been carrying around the title The Axeman's Carnival since 2008. My husband and I had been to the little one-room museum at Tuatapere, and I'd seen photos of the Axeman's Carnival events over the years, so I thought, yes, I want to use that title for a novel. I don't know what novel, but I'll use it one day. And then, I don't know, lots of different things happened at the same time. The way that they usually do with the genesis of a novel, I kind of think about it as tiny iron filings being attracted to a magnet. All these little fragments from different places, all over the place, kind of suddenly coming together, being attracted to this one particular central idea. And so one other thing that happened around that time was that my mother-in-law died, and we got her diaries that she'd kept when my husband was growing up on two different South Island sheep stations, and she was writing about that time. And there was just something about, I don't know, the diaries themselves weren't particularly interesting to read. There were lots of loads of washing talked about, and there was lots of, you know, spinning of wool and knitting talked about. But there was something about learning the kind of rhythms of the farming year and details like, you know, the ground being so frozen in midwinter that the sheep's hooves clatter when they walk across the ground, things like that. I just, and also listening to my husband over the years talk about his experiences growing up there, that coalesced into thinking, okay, I think I want to write something rural. And then I was also thinking about how much I'd enjoyed writing The Wish Child with the particular voice that tells that story, and I won't ruin it for those of you who might still want to read it, but it's told by an unexpected voice, and you don't find out the identity of that narrator until quite late in the piece. And I really loved the challenge of that unusual voice telling the story and wanted to try something like that again. And so I thought, well, could I try something non-human for a change? That would be really setting myself a challenge. I always like to set myself a creative challenge and see if I can solve it and yeah, kind of unpick that knot. So I was thinking, well, I don't know, what animals can talk? There's that husky on YouTube that seems to say, I love you. But that
I'm not really convinced by that. Have you actually watched it?
I have, yeah. Yeah. Anyway. But he doesn't really seem to have enough vocabulary to fill a whole novel. It's basically three words. So I was thinking about a wolf for a while as a kind of a leap to the side from a husky. But then I thought, but that would make it a European story. I think I want to tell a New Zealand story. So then I started thinking about birds. There are lots of minor birds around us where we live, and also lots of magpies. So until the rural land behind our house was kind of swallowed up by a subdivision just over the last couple of years, there were lots of pine trees there and lots of magpies. And the magpies still are there, but just not quite as much of a presence. Yeah, and I realised that when I opened the windows of my writing room every morning, the song of the magpies came flooding into my room. And I'd kind of been hearing that for months and not really putting two and two together, that he's right there, Tama's right there, you know, walking outside on the grass just outside your office. He's kind of been saying to you this whole time, hey, I'm over here. If you want a non-human narrator that can talk, here I am. Yeah.
Was there an appeal of that kind of slightly malevolent gothic kind of element? And I suppose the history of, you know, we had kind of Dennis Glover's The Magpies. And
yeah.
Because there are obviously other, you know, Tui can are actually amazing mimics. There's a Tui in a sanctuary in Wellington that used to do Jeff Robinson impressions from radio in New Zealand.
That's right. But no, it definitely was the slightly kind of sinister nature of magpies that appealed to me. And yeah, as soon as the kind of the idea of the bird presented itself, I realised that yes, it definitely does tie in with this kind of idea for a rural story because they seem to belong to our rural settings. And also that they're black and white, you know, I thought that really dovetails, to make a bad bird pun, that dovetails with the kind of story I like to tell, which has humour in it, has light in it, but also has darkness too.
Yeah. I'm always intrigued with, you know, when you read or watch something that, you know, on the face of it potentially seems ridiculous. And I think, how did that get across the line? Like, you know, what was the pitch? What was your pitch to the publisher?
I mean, it seemed like a good idea at the time. I didn't pitch it. Okay. I never do. I just kind of furtively write away for, you know, 2 years or whatever, or 3 years, or with the wish child, 13 years. And then send them the finished product, usually. I don't say to them, do you think this is a good idea for a novel? I don't know. I find that kind of feedback at such an early stage can be quite devastating to the story. Yeah. So I guess it's kind of a risk to take that you do spend years on a book and then the publisher turns around and says, it's not really for us. That hasn't happened to me yet. But yeah, I think I need to give it my best shot before I really get anyone else's eyes on it. Yeah. Mm.
Tama is named after, you know, those ridiculous electronic pets that were around a while ago called Tamagotchis. Do names matter? Are they important? How do you kind of, do you agonise over them? How do you decide on names?
I do agonise over them. I didn't with Tama, though. That name came to me really quickly because I was thinking about the age of Rob and Marnie and what their childhoods would have been like. And I was thinking, what toys would they have had? That's the kind of thing you do. Well, I do as a writer, even though that's not going to go into the book in any major way. You still kind of have to have this backstory for your characters so that they feel three-dimensional to you and then hopefully will to the reader. And I was thinking about, you know, the Tamagotchi and what a sensation it was and that it was egg-shaped. And I thought, well, okay, perfect. But also, of course, there's the echo of the Māori word or the double meaning of the Māori word, child or boy or son, and Tama is, you know, to all intents and purposes, Marnie's child. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You grew up in the Hutt Valley, mm-hmm. I think, so mm-hmm. I'm guessing you didn't have a lot of exposure to farming practices. But obviously, you know, there are some wonderfully evocative passages in the book, you know, that deal with kind of farming life, from kind of crutching and castrating and docking and the killing sheds. You know, how do you go about the process of researching that sort of level of detail so that it really becomes believable? Mm.
I mean, it was partly my mother-in-law's diaries, and it was partly talking to Alan, poor old Alan. He'd start saying something about his childhood, and I'd say, just hang on a second. I'll just turn on my phone and record you.
So
now, naturally.
Where was the family farm? It was or farms?
He was on a station called Centre Hill, which was in Southland.
Oh, right, so it was kind of in that region.
Yeah. And he did live on Wilderness Road, so that name was such a gift, because, you know, so much of the book is about the clash of the wild and the domestic. Mm. So, yeah, I love it when those kind of gems just fall out of the sky. It was, you know, Alan telling stories about, which you know, I give to Rob, sitting on the porch in his little cowboy outfit when he was probably about four, and the man driving the superphosphate truck comes up, and Alan's got his little toy pistol, and he shoots the man in the superphosphate truck, and the man driving the superphosphate truck falls back in his seat and clutches his chest. And Alan, as a four-year-old, is absolutely terrified and thinks, oh, my God, I've killed him. which is such a great story. So I absolutely had to cannibalise Alan's childhood for details like that. And for, you know, I talked to him a lot about the kind of the grittier side of farming. I'm vegetarian, and I find it really difficult to read stories where horrible things happen to animals. And even, you know, I say to my creative writing students, please don't include stuff like that, because they just lodge in my brain and won't go away, and it's awful. But I knew that I did have to go there with this book in order to do justice to a farming story. So I talked to about five high country sheep station farmers in central Otago, who my cousins are farmers in a different part of the country, and they were able to put me in touch with them, and they were all so lovely and so gracious with their time. And, you know, I would interview them about certain aspects and then go away and write those scenes and then email the scenes to them and say, have I got this right? And I would also talk a lot to my cousin who lives in Hawke's Bay, who's a sheep farmer, but she's also an agricultural journalist and kind of has her finger on the pulse of what's going on with sheep farming. So she was really helpful. And even, you know, I just wanted to get every detail absolutely right. Like, I was quite confused about how do dog commands work when there's more than one dog there? Like, like if you're calling out, you know, get in behind, do they all get in behind? Or what happens? Do you have to use their names? And if you are using their names, do you have to say the dog's name first and then the command? Or does it matter if it's the other way around? You know, things like that. And the feedback from those readers has been, yes, you got it absolutely right. So that's always a relief.
Yeah, that must be exciting. But at the same time, you know, it does, when you're writing about such diverse subjects, you are reliant on people helping you with kind of their expertise and their knowledge. I think I read a funny little excerpt that in Iceland there's a whole heaps of crime writers and only one forensic pathologist. So he started running seminars because he got tired of answering their questions all the time.
I love that.
So I just wondered, how do you, you know, how do you kind of decide who to ask and get in touch? And, you know, do people ever say no? Or how does it
not work? Usually, actually. No, not usually. You know, I included a really beautiful creation story in the book as well. I was, you know, researching stories, legends around magpies, and in particular around the Australian magpie, which is a different species from the European magpie. The European magpie is not a songbird the way that the Australian magpie is, the way that Tama is. And yeah, one of those gifts of research, I found this lovely creation story about the origin of the first dawn, and that the earth was sort of covered in darkness, and all the creatures of the earth had to crawl along on their bellies because the sky was pressed so close to the earth, and only the snakes were happy, until the clever magpies had the idea of propping the sky up with sticks and climbing onto rocks and then climbing onto hills and then climbing onto mountains higher and higher, pushing the sky up and up with sticks until the darkness flew into pieces and the light of the sun woman's fire fell across the earth, and that was the first dawn. And I thought, wow, that's a beautiful story. And it's also a story about the cleverness of the magpie, and that is absolutely central to, I guess, the moral of the book is, if there is a moral to it, is that you can pit cleverness against brute strength. So I knew that I wanted to use that story and thought, I need to try and get permission to use it because it's an Aboriginal story. And so, yeah, I made contact with an outfit in Australia called the Mudjar Aboriginal Corporation, who were the people most closely associated with that particular legend, and explained what I was doing, said, is it okay with you if I write a retelling of it and put it in my novel? And again, they were just so lovely and so welcoming and generous and said, yes, that sounds amazing. Can you send us a copy when it's written? So I emailed the scene to them, and they said, oh, we really love it. We're going to show it to our board of directors and put it in our newsletter. And yeah.
Wonderful.
The book's about to come out in Australia early next year, so I'll send them a copy of the Australian version when it comes out. So it's really always a matter of just asking people in the right way, not kind of barging in and saying, this is my material to use, but just, yeah, approaching it with a little bit of humility, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I see in your acknowledgements there's also an Officer Cho at the LA Police Department.
Oh, yes.
I wondered where he or she fitted in.
So he was really helpful. Tama picks up snippets of dialogue from TV, from radio, from YouTube videos that Marnie's watching. And at one point in the book, he's parroting, all these bits and pieces from cop shows, from LA-based cop shows. And I particularly for the scene where he's using radio talk, so police radio talk, I wanted to... There were kind of two layers to that. I wanted to make sure that I had it right, but then also it didn't necessarily have to be right because it was a TV show and they take liberties all the time, especially that kind of show that I was talking about. So, yeah, I familiarised myself with the codes that the LAPD use for particular crimes that are underway. And then, yeah, managed to contact Officer Cho, who was very helpful, and he said, yeah, those are the right codes for those particular sorts of events, but we don't necessarily use them on the radios because it's easier just to use plain talk and to say, you know, this is what's unfolding. But on a TV cop show, the writers of those shows tend to think that we do use those codes, so it probably would be okay to use them. Yeah.
And there's also a credit for Pecky Sharp.
Pecky Sharp, yes.
Did you meet Pecky Sharp or did you just send a list of questions to be quite a little rattled back?
So a friend of mine, Marty Smith, who's also a writer, lives in Hawke's Bay and has had various resident magpies over the years, and Pecky was resident there for a while. Just towards the end of the writing of the book, actually, I realised that Pecky was living with Marty and was very often inside the house. I didn't really ask Pecky many questions during the writing of the book, but I did double check some things with her during the editing of it. And this is a version of Pecky's claw print. Yeah. And Pecky was also the stunt double for a few publicity photos that were used at launch. Yeah, where Tama was in the naughty corner and couldn't attend the launch, and there were like empty booze bottles and cigarette papers.
Seems like he spends quite a lot of time there.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, on a more serious note, one of the central threads of the novel is about domestic violence. You know, Rob gets drunk, jealous, angry, and hits Marnie. How did these kinds of things come about? Going back to the genesis of the novel, and you started with the title. You know, do you decide that you want to write a book that includes this, or did that come as a natural kind of extension of couples struggling with financial issues on the farm? How did that come about?
It did seem to belong to that sort of story that men like Rob are under enormous pressure when the farm is failing, when the farm is struggling. And, you know, one of the key ingredients of successful fiction is conflict. And I knew that, you know, Tama was going to have this really close relationship with Marnie, and therefore the third person in that story needed to somehow be in opposition to that really tight bond. And so, yeah, it really grew out of that I wanted to kind of really work with the tension that kind of threesome suggested. Yeah.
Do we want to do a little reading?
Yes. So perhaps I'll do the earlier one, seeing as we're talking about tension between Tama and Rob.
Sorry, that was the intention, yes.
So in this little snippet, Tama is parroting all these phrases that he's picked up from cop shows and from YouTube. He also whistles a song. It various stages throughout the book, he says, you know, that he's whistling this song or that song that he's heard. This also talks about the tension in their household. Marnie's kind of walking on eggshells, trying to stop Tama from just aggravating Rob so much, because Marnie knows that it won't end well for her, and it probably won't end well for Tama either if he keeps annoying Rob. It also mentions a costume that Tama is wearing. He wears different outfits throughout the book that Marnie then photographs him wearing and puts online for his fans. Okay. Rob wasn't sleeping and it was my fault. I kept hearing things on the TV and the radio and Marnie's phone, and I kept wanting to practice them for her, and sometimes I practiced them at night. They croaked and rattled out of me, those unwieldy human words. I couldn't keep my trap shut. That's cocaine, all right, Trent. Book him. And how can I love you if you won't let me in? And watch the weight melt away before your very eyes. And I will take you down, motherfucker. I said them in my bed, tucked under my yellow blanket, my bear unravelling next to me and the eye watching us both. Tama, Tama, whispered Marnie. And she was a shadow above me as the sun, moon, stars, clouds turned on their threads. You need to be quiet. You'll wake him, please. But I knew she loved to hear me speak in her language. You have the right to remain silent, I said. Anything you say can and will be used against you. In the morning, Rob crashed around the kitchen and I kept my distance, jumping at every loud noise. He snatched at the radio to turn it off, then banged his coffee cup down next to it, stabbed his knife into the cold-hearted butter like a monster. I swear to God, Marnie, one more night like that and I will lose it. I adjusted my Superman costume. He can't help himself, Rob. He's just following his instincts. My instinct is to wring his neck. All right with you if I follow it? To be fair, you weren't sleeping that well before he arrived. He's got to go, Marnie. If you won't get rid of him, I will. We tried taking him back to the Pines, remember? He wants to live here. Well, you made sure he can't survive in the wild. This is his home. His home. Ours. It's our home. And what about all his followers? They'd be gutted. It's not natural. In news just to hand, I said, a serious crash at the Tuckanini off-ramp has closed State Highway 1. Jesus fucking Christ, shut up, said Rob. I started to whistle, there's nay luck aboot the hoose, and he roared. I suppose I should have tried to behave myself, and I was wary of him, don't get me wrong. I saw the strength in his hard hands, and I knew it could lead nowhere good. I knew he'd had a gutsful, but I couldn't keep quiet. I was my own worst enemy. Me and my friends were like twerking, I said. He came for me then, lurching through the air, flailing and flightless. Meow, I said as I dived for the cat door. And then I was out and soaring into the brittle white day, my Superman cape flaring out behind me.
Brilliant.
So, I mean, we see Rob's attacks on Marnie through Tama's eyes. I mean, was that part of the appeal of a non-human narrator in that it could be a kind of naive witness trying to make sense of something for the first time?
Yeah, definitely. It is only told through Tama's eyes, so we only see the human world through his lens. And it was a way of talking about the strangenesses of our human behaviours and habits. And, you know, at first Tama doesn't quite understand what's going on in this house, and he thinks, well, that's how houses work. That's just kind of the rules around how houses work and how marriages work. And then, yeah, gradually he understands that, no, actually, I need to defend her. This isn't right, what's happening. Yeah. Hmm.
Some of the most chilling scenes are those kind of on the morning after, with its parade of excuses. You know I'd never hurt you, not on purpose. I'm no monster. That wasn't me last night. That was the beer. You shouldn't let me drink so much. It won't happen again. You're not going to say anything, right?
Yeah.
I think you've said that those were some of the most difficult passages to write. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, because it's never, you know, it's never black and white, I think, a relationship like Rob and Marnie's. She loves Rob still, but she's scared of him too, but she's also scared of leaving him. And I think that's not uncommon for women in a situation like that to feel that there's nowhere they can turn. They know that they should leave, but if they leave, it might make things worse because that might aggravate their partner even more to the point where, you know, they'll come after them and they'll kill them, and that has happened. And the other reason, you know, the complicating factor is children and staying for their sake or staying for financial reasons to be able to support them. And so that's part of Marnie's kind of quandary as well, that she can't leave Tama. He's her baby. She can't leave him. And she definitely can't leave him in the hands of Rob.
You use a lot of repetition in different contexts, and one of the words that comes up again and again is the word monster. Mm. I mean, is Rob a monster?
Oh, he has that side to him for sure, but I'm never interested in writing one-dimensional villains. He is the villain of the story. Yeah, he is. Then so is Dietrich Hahn, who's the SS officer in Remote Sympathy. And yet I went to great pains to make both of those characters, you know, human as well, and more than just cardboard cutouts. I want the reader to have moments where they sympathise with those monsters, and for the reader to catch themselves thinking, "Oh, is that okay that I just felt a twinge of sympathy for that person?"
Because I pulled one out, but which I, yeah, you can't in you can't avoid feeling sympathetic. It's where he's just despairing of the financial situation, really. It says, "One night in the dead of winter, he came in from the farm and drank and drank and drank. He sat with his head in his hands. He said, 'We're so far in the red, we'll never get out. We can't keep making a loss. You chose the wrong man. You married a loser.'"
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the truth comes out when he's been drinking. Mm. He's an angry and disappointed man, and he's the son of an angry and disappointed man, and he's kind of inherited that the bad decisions that his father made about the farm. And he's at breaking point, which is not to excuse what he does, but it's to kind of give some context for it. Yeah.
I mean, your books do explore some pretty difficult and disturbing themes. How do do you carry that with you emotionally? How do you deal with it as you're writing them?
Yeah, I think I did with the two Germany books. And that was for about 20 years all up that I was kind of delving into that very dark material. But it wouldn't leave me alone either, you know, those two stories. They got under my skin the way that all of my stories do. I think in The Axeman's Carnival, yes, there definitely is that sort of darkness at the heart of the story, but it's leavened by a talking bird and by those moments of humour. I mean, I loved inhabiting Tama for the length of a novel. He's very real to me. When I was flying down to the Queenstown Writers Festival last year, because Tama is on Twitter, he tweets, obviously, because he's a bird. And when I was writing the book, when I was actually proofreading it, I read that, that's right, I included Tama's Twitter handle in the book. I wonder if anyone will go to Twitter and see if he's there. He better be there. He better have a presence on Twitter. So anyway, but I was flying down to the Queenstown Writers Festival and I was snapping some pictures from the window of the plane so that Tama could tweet about flying himself down there. When we landed, and I was thinking, oh, you know, I wonder if Tama will get there ahead of me, and thinking about what he might tweet. And then we landed, and the very first thing I saw on the grass at the side of the runway was a magpie. And my immediate thought was, oh, he did get there ahead of me. And then I had to say to myself, no, Catherine, he's not real. He's in your head. Yes, that is a magpie, but it's not Tama that you made up in your head. Yeah.
I mean, do you have... Because you write, I think, very early in the morning and very late at night and have a day job in between. Do you have a way that you kind of reset when you're finished writing in order to kind of let your brain kind of get back to the next thing?
Yeah, I do have a very busy schedule. It's kind of an insane schedule. I like writing early in the morning. I am not a morning person, but it's, you know, it's the only time of day that I can fit it in. I think it works well for me because I am still kind of in that half asleep, dreamy state when I open up the laptop and I can just kind of, yeah, dream my way back into the story. I find it's really useful to leave off the writing at a point where I haven't quite finished, so that it's easier to pick it up again. Mm. Something that Janet Frame talked about as well, that if you leave when you've still got something else to say, then it's easier to find your way back into it. Yeah,
it's interesting because it's kind of counterintuitive. You think, I don't want to lose that thread because I'm partway there.
Yeah.
Do you want to do the second reading?
And we'll come
back to...
So this is a little bit later in the book where Tama has become an internet sensation and Rob and Marnie are ordering a whole lot of magpie merch. And this is where the prototype Tama toy is arriving in the mail. So the plush Tama toy, you press his wing and he says these catchphrases that have been recorded that are the real Tama. Recordings of the real Tama. It mentions one of them, "Don't you dare," which becomes Tama's sort of major catchphrase online and sparks all these "Don't you dare" memes. And that was from a scene where Tama was refusing to vacate the marital bed and Rob was getting more and more enraged and Marnie was filming it and it became a sort of a viral clip online with Tama kind of darting around the bed just out of Rob's clutches and Rob saying to Marnie, you get that thing out of here and don't you dare let it back in. And so the toy Tama, when it says "don't you dare," is actually Rob saying "don't you dare" as Tama because Tama on the day of recording refused to say his catchphrase. So that's all kind of by way of background to this little scene, but it's kind of a scene where... I'm playing with the idea of mimicry and the idea of ventriloquism that I just had so much fun with in the book. And Tama is feeling quite threatened by this this new arrival. "One day soon afterwards, I saw Marnie walking up the gravel holding a new bird, a new magpie. In one hand, the letters from the letterbox, and in the other, this pretender, this rival. She must have rescued it. She must have found it down on Wilderness Road, clipped by a car perhaps, or attacked by a cat. Though it was no juvenile, no helpless fledgling, it was my size. She nuzzled it with her cheek, tucked it in close to her neck, and it stayed there quite still and obedient, a good boy. Not the type of boy to steal a lamb's severed tail and give it to a baby. 'Rob,' she called, 'come and see.' She sat the bird on the kitchen table, which was not very sanitary. God knows where the creature had been. And they both looked at it, heads tilted. 'I think they've caught him,' said Rob. 'I love him,' said Marnie." She loved him. She loved him. Rob clapped his hands as if killing a mosquito. "Perfect," he said. "Let's keep this one and get rid of the other, and I'll be able to sleep." "Very funny," said Marnie, but I did not laugh. She noticed me by the back door then, skulking, sulking. "Tama," she said, "meet Tama." Even my name. "I'm Tama," I tried to say. "I'm Tama." Except it didn't come out as human words. I felt an old territorial call surge up inside me and boil in my throat. And although I thought I did not remember it, I threw back my head and caroled, "We are here and this is our tree and we're staying and it is ours and you need to leave and now." It was as if Marnie hadn't heard me at all. She sat down at the kitchen table and pressed the new bird's wing and on her command, a good boy, the best boy, he spoke. And he spoke with my voice. "Good morning and welcome," he said. "I'm Tama." "Not bad, eh?" said Marnie. "It's like he's in the room with us," said Rob. "I'm Tama," I said. "I'm Tama." But again, the territorial call I didn't remember remembering. "We are here and this is our tree." "Shh," Marnie said to me over her shoulder. She pressed the trespasser's wing again, and again he spoke with my voice. "I would like to gobble you up." "Press." "Yum, yum, yum." "Press." "That's not funny." "Press." "Meow." "Just like the real one," said Marnie. But there was something not quite right about this bird. He was too still, and he spoke without opening his beak. I wasn't even sure his feathers were real. They had no sheen, no oily luster. I flew to the table, landed right beside him. He didn't look right, and he didn't smell right. I aimed a peck at his dull black belly, and over he toppled, legs in the air, past his prime, death by a tama. Rob let out a laugh. "It's you, bird brain." "It's a toy tama," said Marnie. "A toy tama." "A toy tama," I said. "A toy tama." I tipped it upside down and listened for the clunk, but it had no heart. Marnie pressed its wing once more. "Don't you dare," it said. And this time I did not hear myself. No, not myself. Just a toy faking Rob's voice, faking my voice, faking Rob's voice. "What do you think?" said Marnie. "Can't even tell," said Rob.
Brilliant.
And one of the questions raised by Marnie keeping Tama is this idea of the ethics of pets, of domestication of wild animals. I mean, you have a cat, two cats?
We have two cats. Two cats. We have in the past had five one time.
But so yes. Do you ever think about, you know, I guess the ethics of keeping your cats or just, you know, animals in general, I guess, is that where this idea came from?
Yeah, there was an interview that I gave a wee while ago to one of the, you know, the Sunday supplements in the Sunday newspapers. And when it came out, I was on the front cover with this big blaring headline saying, "I am guilty of dressing cats to put on Facebook," which is unfortunately true. Yeah, we had a couple of cats who didn't mind being dressed. The most kind of placid one was Jiffy, who I've written about in my children's books. So yeah, he used to wear little costumes and he had quite a following on Facebook. But I am also aware that there's that really fine line between entertainment and exploitation, and you know, looking at the phenomenon of Grumpy Cat, for instance, who I had in mind with Tama and the way that Tama just absolutely takes over the internet. I would see kind of, I don't know, celebrity appearance photos of Grumpy Cat and he didn't often look very happy. and, you know, for Marnie, Tama starts earning a serious income because of all these sort of, you know, advertising deals and things. And he might be the answer to the failure of their farm. He might be able to turn things around for her. So, of course, she's absolutely invested in that because that might then, you know, give her back the man that she married and everything might be okay again in this sort of magical scenario she has in her head. So that's her motivation in some ways. But, yeah, that, you know, the internet can be a really rabid place and you have no control over the material that you put out there once it's out there. And the followers, the fans, can turn quite feral. And there's a scene where something, you know, terrible is happening to Marnie, but most of the followers are far more concerned about the bird. Yeah,
and I find that really striking. There's a, you know, there's one person that's in, it's in capital letters or something. You know, it's like there's a woman being attacked.
Yeah,
it's like, what is the matter with you people? You're all obsessed with this bird, and nobody sees what's really happening. I mean, what is your relationship with social media? Because obviously, as a writer, promotion is part of the job in a way. Do you use it much? How do you manage that kind of relationship?
I'm most present on Facebook, but that's not just kind of book stuff. That's more, you know, keeping in touch with friends and just, yeah, having that sense of community with other writers that you really don't have when you're sitting by yourself in a room for years on end kind of typing away. So I really like it for that. More recently, I've been on Twitter, which is kind of more for sort of book stuff because I feel the pressure to rather than because I really love it or that I take to it naturally. I don't understand Instagram at all. I don't understand TikTok at all. I think I probably should, but I feel like I already spend enough time on social media. I don't need another addiction. Yeah, I have a love-hate relationship with it. I was flying back from a festival recently, and I was sitting across the aisle on the plane from a woman who was reading Remote Sympathy. I thought, oh my God, that's amazing. So I took a furtive little photo, not of her, she wasn't identifiable, but just of, you know, the fact that someone was holding Remote Sympathy on the plane. And I posted it on Twitter, and lots of my friends were like, oh my God, that's amazing, and other writers were saying, oh, I've always wanted that to happen, you know, see someone in the world reading my book. But then lots of other people were saying, what's that on her lap? And she was holding this kind of pink and yellow scarf on her lap that just coincidentally had fallen into the shape of a frozen chicken. And everyone online started saying, is that a frozen chicken on her lap? Like, people who didn't know me, who just kind of stumbled across this thing on their feed, were going, hey, what is that woman, you know, holding a raw poultry on her lap on the plane? Ha ha. And it sort of turned into this completely different kind of post than what I'd intended. It was meant to be my beautiful moment of seeing a complete stranger right next to me reading my book, and it turned into something else entirely. So, you know, you can't control what happens to your content once you put it out there. Mm. And yeah, you know, what happens with Tama and his followers and his online presence is kind of an illustration of that too, that it sort of veers off in a quite unexpected direction. Mm. Yeah.
Look, I do want to get to questions because I'm sure you've got a lot of questions to ask, Catherine. I just had one more question that I did want to ask. Just obviously, this you have won two of the Acorn prizes, and which I'm sure you know increases your profile, which has, you know, inevitably some of those both benefits and advantages. But I was just interested, how important are awards to you? And I guess there's different elements of that, you know, as a writer, as validation of your work, but also in terms of the financial implications, whether that is in the case of the Acorn, which comes with a $60,000, I think, now,
$64,000,
yeah. Amazing. But also, you know, in terms of the commercial success of the book, how important is that?
I mean, it's lovely to win. Of course it is. Tama and I were ecstatic to be taking home the Acorn. He tried to eat it, but, you know. But you never know how those things are going to play out. And I've been, you know, in the position of sitting there in the auditorium and hearing someone else's name called, and that's all just part of it. You can't place too much stock on what that success means to you as a writer, and does it mean that I'm a success or that I'm a failure? Because if you start to do that, then you'll get so kind of tied up in knots that you'll stop writing, I think. So it is really important for a book's profile to be longlisted, to be shortlisted, to win a prize. It definitely helps. And $64,000 definitely doesn't go astray. You know, that's a great kind of level of security for someone in the creative arts. Novels aren't ever really going to pay the bills. But, yeah, I try not to sort of get too invested in what it means for me and my identity as a writer. Yeah.
I mean, how do you feel when you finish a book? Do you instantly know, yes, that's a cracker?
I don't know. I think I I know the book's finished when I feel like it's as good as I can make it. It's where I want it to be. And, yeah, I do feel a huge rush at that point and a huge sense of achievement and satisfaction. But you can never tell how a reader is going to react to it. Like with Tama, I did feel like... I think this is a book that New Zealanders will really love, and I did feel like it was, you know, kind of a homecoming for me as a writer to be setting a book in New Zealand again. And I just loved writing it. It wasn't easy because my writing never comes easily to me. It's always a real hard slog. But it felt... there was something quite charmed about the writing of the X-Men's Carnival that I hadn't felt for a while. Yeah.
Brilliant. All right, look, I do want to open the floor to questions, gentle reminder, questions, not statements. You will need a roving microphone so that the questions will be recorded for the podcast. So if you would like to ask a question, if you can just raise your hand and someone will come and bring you a microphone.
This isn't really about the writing. Because I was out of the country, I actually read the book on Kindle, and I was interested, do you get the same income from Kindle as you do from the proper book?
I think the percentage is different. I have to check my contract. I think for, you know, paper books, the writer usually gets about 10% before tax. With Kindle, I think it's about... With ebooks, I think it's about 25%, but then the retail price is less, so it kind of evens out. Yeah.
Thank you.
I was really interested in the accuracy that you got in the around the farming scenes and how you were so diligent about pinpointing that. Where did you go to for advice on the domestic violence scenes? Because you really seem to capture that.
Yeah, thank you. Talking to a few friends and then acquaintances that they put me in touch with who'd been in relationships like that, who were also, you know, really generous with their time. I asked them if they wanted to be included in the acknowledgements at the back of the book, realising that they probably wouldn't, and yeah, none of them did want to be, which is absolutely fine. But yeah, they're there between the lines. Yeah, yeah. And again, it was a matter of, you know, asking in the right way. Yeah, asking with sensitivity.
I'm interested in your relationship with the bird, and like you've gone into a lot of research around domestic violence and farming and everything, but what about birds? How do you feel about birds now?
Oh, I'm glad you talk about my relationship with the bird because Tama is real. I did a huge amount of research around the Australian magpie and in particular read a lot of the writings, scientific papers as well as the book of an Australian expert called Gisela Kaplan, who has literally written the book on the Australian magpie. And a lot of that informed the way that Tama behaves and the way that he is physically in the book. So, for instance, you know, a real gift of that research was realising that because of the placement of their eyes, which are laterally placed on the side of their head, they can see two things at once. And that absolutely fed into this duality in the book, you know, black and white, dark and light, seeing two sides of things, the domestic and the wild. So that felt like it was really meant to be. And so did what I learned about magpie vocalisation, that they can sing two notes at once. And, you know, Tama has two voices in the book. He has the voice that he uses to talk to us, to tell his story, which is quite sophisticated and often quite poetic. And that's his voice that he hears inside his head. But there's also the voice that is everything that appears within quotation marks, which is the things that he's mimicking, which are quite different and often quite jarring or unintentionally comical. So, yeah, I use the kind of the science of it to talk about, the material that I use symbolically in the book. And I love when my research can kind of be manipulated in that way. Yeah.
Can they actually mimic speech? Because I did.
Oh yes,
I looked at YouTube and I found, you know, they do mimic dog barking and sirens. But
They absolutely can talk. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Amazing. Any other questions back?
Yeah. Hi. I'm not aware of your Facebook cats that you talk about, but you talk about Tama very endearingly, even now in a present sense as well. Is there? Do you see something of yourself and Marnie, the character, and her relationship with the bird?
Yes, I definitely do. I think in all of my books, when I look back at them, it wasn't really a conscious decision, but there's very often a theme around children that are lost somehow, or children that are deeply wanted, or families that are unconventional, that are kind of put together in a way that is not your typical nuclear family, mothers who desperately want a child but can't have a child, and that, you know, that is absolutely something that speaks to my history of going through infertility and ultimately surrogacy. So I see myself in Marnie. I am in Marnie's character, in the way that she desperately wants this little thing to look after and to nurture and to love, who belongs to her. Yeah.
When you look around at this room full of women in particular, I think I've seen two or three men, what is it about stories that you think is so important to women?
Mm. That's a really interesting question. I don't know that I know the answer to that. I have the same observation as you at these events, that it usually is largely women who come to them. And it seems to me that it's usually women who buy the books. In my job teaching creative writing at tertiary level, there's a far higher number of women students than there are men in my workshops. I don't know why that is. Maybe we're traditionally the holders of story, and that we're the ones who put the children to bed and tell them stories and make up our own stories and value story. But yeah, I don't know what the right answer to that is.
Interesting.
This is a man speaking.
Excellent. Welcome.
I thought it was time. Hey, apart from all the glories of the story and the colour of the characters and all the rest, I wanted to ask you, Catherine, on another level, and it's similar with all your books, from the first book I read of yours, In the Fishbone Church, which I love the symbolic and imaginative level of that book. And I'm wondering, does the book also attend to or pose some kind of existential question about us as human beings now? Because the setting of the natural world, and even beyond farming, is something also, apart from the narrative, the whole spatial quality of the book, is so compelling. And I wondered if the book, you kind of partly wrote it because of some existential questions that were in your mind about us.
Yeah, I think they were definitely there, possibly not on a conscious level, but in the book, you know, the story is set against this backdrop of drought and of the threat of the natural world kind of encroaching on the human world, and of nature winning, you know. It's such a kind of an unforgiving environment that Rob and Marnie are trying to eke out a living in, and Tama is of that natural world. And, you know, the house is kind of falling down around them. The house isn't withstanding the kind of the elements that it's been exposed to over the years, and neither are they really. So I was kind of thinking about those bigger questions and our place in that natural world, and that we are really usurpers in the same way that Tama is a bit of a usurper. He's an Australian who's taken up residence here. But I like that those bigger themes are kind of there underneath the surface to be thinking about if a reader wants to. Yeah, thank you for identifying that.
We have, unfortunately, run out of time. So many more questions that we could all ask, because it's such a fascinating story, and it's such a pleasure to have you here, Catherine. Now, you're running off to another event, my goodness, later today. This is the life of someone in great demand. So it's been an absolute pleasure and privilege to have you here. And again, Catherine will be signing books outside after the session, if you want to go and buy a book or bring one that you have already. But if you would like to join me in thanking Catherine so much for being here.